specific area at all. Actually, it's almost North Pacific, not quite. We're on Emerald right here. And for your information, you know, this is New Britain, New Ireland, New Hanover, New Guinea. You know where New Guinea is.
Yeah.
Australia's down here. And we were up here near the equator, and the equatorial front goes up and back twice a year. We get really rain on.
Well, so with that material to look at later, we may want to refer to that more.
Yeah.
Why don't we start by just checking to make sure we're getting this, and you guys can just start asking some questions.
Do you want to do the level tunes? You don't have the same ones. Well, we can just go back and forth.
Okay. And remember, that, guys, you're going to have to speak up because okay. I'm getting old and my hearing isn't all that great. And when you whisper, I don't hear you.
Okay. So,
sorry.
What branch?
You don't have to shout, but just you're doing very well.
What branch of the Army were you in?
I wasn't in the Army. I was in the Marine Corps. It's not part of the Army. It's part of the Navy, if anything.
Could you describe what Marines are? What do they do then?
Well, Marines started during the Revolutionary War. They were the first group. There was no Navy, there was no Army, but there was a Marine Corps. And they became famous just after the Revolutionary War when they went and fought against the Barbary pirates in the Mediterranean, because the Barbary pirates were plundering all the ships that sailed up and down the Mediterranean. So that was their first major battle. And the officers have a little gizmo on the top of their hat so that guys up in the cross arms of the ships could look down and see who the officers were. And you took care of the officers. I was not an officer. I was an enlisted citizen here. I was a master technical sergeant. And that R shouldn't be on there. I was in the regular Marine Corps. And there's a difference. You know, I signed up for 4 years to the day. The war was over, but I had to stay in because I was in the regulars. And I had to wait till April 20th. I enlisted April 20th, 1942. The war started in December 41, you may know. And it took me that long to figure out what I wanted to do. So I was going to go in the Air Force. And I wanted to be a navigator or a bombardier, one of the two, because I wasn't sharp enough to be a pilot. But a friend of mine came home from the Marine Corps wearing his dress blues and all, you know, he looked beautiful, you know. And he said, "What do you want to go in the Air Force for? Join the Marines." So I did. So go ahead with your questions.
Okay. How old were you when you joined?
I was 19. The war was won. I have to interject things as we go along. The war was won by teenagers. The guys that kept our airplanes flying were 17, 18, 19 years old. And we owed our life to them. Because every time you flew, you never knew if you were going to get back or not. You know, we always figured we would, and I did. I was lucky. But I really want to impress the point. And it was the same in Europe. These guys that fought in the Battle of the Bulge and, you know, all that, they were teenage kids. There were some of their officers were older. Our pilots were 22, 23, 25. We thought they were old guys, you know. They weren't. But we thought they were older than we were. They'd gone to college a little bit. We hadn't. A lot of us hadn't. Okay, go ahead.
So, why did you join?
Well, I just explained. Because we were at war, and this was total war. And it wasn't a matter of staying out. You got drafted or you went in voluntarily, and I didn't want to be drafted, because if you got drafted, you went in the Army. I did not want to go in the Army. So, as I said, this friend of mine came home in his dress blue Marine uniform and said, "Why do you want to join the Air Force?" You know, so I joined the Marine Corps. I was going to save the world, you know. We all were.
Where did you live before you joined?
I was in Connecticut, in a little village in Connecticut called Middle Padham. It's on the map, but barely.
did Did you go in after or before Pearl Harbor?
After. There weren't many that went in before. Because, you know, we were all trying to, it was the Great Depression. We were just beginning to get over it. We were supporting England, you know, bombs for Britain and all that. And I had a job in a factory that made anti-aircraft shells. And I was making pretty good money for a high school kid. And I wanted to go to college. I really was going to go to college. So I didn't have enough money. Everybody was poor in those days. We were poor. Everybody was poor. We didn't know the difference, you know. I mean, so you're poor, so what, you know. So I was working, and so I didn't go in before. But when the war came, it became evident that, you know, we all had to do our part, do something. And we did.
What was life like for you during that time?
What was what?
What was life like during for you?
Well, geez, I could talk for an hour about that, because it was a different world. It was innocent. Girls your age could go out, ride a bicycle anywhere. Nobody would ever bother them. When I was your age, I was riding my bicycle for miles and miles. My mother would say, "Where are you going?" I'd say, "Out," because I didn't know where I was going. We could go anywhere. It was safe to do that. And the Depression was still on. And, you know, we had a big vegetable garden, and my mother canned everything. And I worked. I was lucky. I've always been lucky to be able to get jobs. And I got jobs doing yard work for people. And I bought all my own clothes, so my mother didn't have to buy them. My father was living out in New Mexico, and he had a job, but it didn't pay much. But at least he had a job, which a lot of people didn't, you know. So I think it was pretty good, and looking back on it, I think that I grew up at the right time. It was an innocent time. It was just great, really. My childhood, I wouldn't trade my childhood with anybody. I lived in a village near the Connecticut River, and I had a canoe. I paid $5 for the canoe. I fixed it up, put new canvas on it, and did all these wonderful things, you know, really. Never thought anything would happen to us. We would go down, and there was a big sandbank by the river, and we'd dig back in the sand and make caves and sit in there and leer out at the world, you know. And then we'd come back 2 days later, it'd all be collapsed. We'd dig it out again, never thinking that it could have collapsed when we were in it. And nobody knew where to look for us, because my mother said, "Where are you going?" "Out." I didn't know if I was going down to the river or up in the hills or where.
When you were in the military itself, describe life during that time.
Well, again, it was lucky. In those days, well, still they have boot camp, you know. And there's two boot camps, one in San Diego and one in Parris Island, South Carolina. And if you're from the East Coast, you go to Parris Island. That's where I went. And for 10 weeks, went through boot camp. And it was very strenuous. And if one person screwed up, you know, they'd say, you know, "Fall out," and boy, we had to get down the stairs and stand at attention and all that. And if one kid came down late, we all went back up, and we'd do that until everybody was on time, you know. And we hated our drill instructor. We called him DIs. We hated him. We would have killed him, I think, you know. But the fact is, that's what they wanted. They were teaching us responsibility. And we were all farm kids, you know, kids from small towns, some kids from cities. And we hadn't had any military training. I, growing up in the country, learned how to shoot a rifle. But I never was a very good shot. But they taught us how to take care of ourselves. And by the time we got out of boot camp, the only people we had respect for was somebody that were tougher than we were. Really, it's hard to believe that. Now I don't feel that way at all anymore. But at the time, boy, that was it. You had to be tough. We did physical drill, underarms, they call it, with a rifle, you know, all this stuff. And we'd march and march and turn back and forth. And we were the best marching platoon there, and everybody would come and watch us, you know, because we did fantastic things. It was neat. I wouldn't want to do it again, but it was a wonderful, life-altering experience. And from boot camp, I was lucky. Most of the guys in my platoon, I don't know, like 64 people in a platoon, I'm not sure, something like that. I'd say about 15 of them, including me, were sent up to Quantico, Virginia, to the Marine Air Corps. And the rest of them went to the Fleet Marine Force. I don't know how many of those guys survived, because they are the ones that landed on Tarawa, and Tinian, Saipan, Guam, and Iwo Jima, all at least Okinawa. But I was in the Air Force, and they sent me up to Quantico, and I was I didn't ask, they just assigned me to ordnance school. That's guns, bombs, and fuses, machine guns, cannons, all that stuff. Everything that aircraft would use. And I, again, lucked out. I wasn't trying to be one of the top of the class. I wasn't the top, I don't think. But I was one of five of our class. It must have been about 50 or so in the class. I made corporal. And they kept me on as a teacher. And Quantico was wonderful. Quantico was about 40 miles south of Washington, D.C. It was like a college campus. It was just fabulous. I could have stayed there the whole war. But after a couple of years, I decided I wanted to be a hero, you know. I didn't put it in those terms, but I just felt that I needed to do something more than just teach bombs and fuses, which was my responsibility. So they opened up an aircraft navigator bombardier school, and I applied and was accepted. And that's when I joined this outfit. Well, this was the patch we wore, and those are my navigator bombardier wings and a name patch. And so I went overseas as a navigator bombardier and went to Emeril. Where are we here? Right there. And I don't know, did you ever see Tales of the South Pacific, the movie, or anything? Well, there's a wonderful song in there called Bally High. And you probably heard it. Bally High was a small island you could only see when the light was right. And there was a bigger island behind it. This was all fictitious. But on Emeril, where are we? Right here. Musau was a big island with a volcano. And there was an island in front of it, but you could only see when the light was right. It was just incredible. But at that time, we had never heard about Tales of the South Pacific or anything, but I just remember that was a real coincidence. And that island, they'd moved all the women. I mean, these were Melanesian people. They weren't very attractive at all to us, but they moved all the women off Musau off Emeril over to Musau. And we couldn't go over there. That was off limits. Could not go there at all.
And what was the function of your unit there then?
Our major job was to fly down here and bomb the devil out of Rabaul Harbor. Where are we here? Right here. We also bombed targets all up and down New Ireland and New Hanover. And now and then we flew up to Truk to sink ships, Japanese ships. And I'm just lucky. We lost five airplanes, five air crews. And three of them were out of my tent. That was kind of spooky. When you lost three guys, we had four people in a tent. And one by one, they went. But I didn't. You know, I just lucked out. As like I said, I've been lucky the whole time. So I flew 59 missions, bombing missions, and search missions, and stuff like that.
And what kind of aircraft?
B-25s. We call them PBJs. Mitchell B-25. They're two-engine. This picture something here.
Is that the one they have at the Evergreen Museum?
I don't know. I've never been there. It may be.
They have B-25 or B-29. I don't know which.
Yeah. Well, there's a big difference. B-25s. Yeah. The B-26 was similar, but it had a single tail. B-25s had two tails. They both of them had two engines.
And you were a navigator?
I was a navigator bombardier.
You want
to navigate to the target, run the bomb site over the target, navigate home again. You know, everybody else was taking it easy.
And so, do you recall if you could actually witness the result of your bombing?
No, see, that's one thing. If you're in the Air Force, unless you're strafing, and we did some of that, but most of it was bombing a fairly high level. For us, high level, 13,000 feet isn't very high anymore. But that's what we were doing, flying. And in here somewhere, there's a picture of one of our squadrons, you know, with flak, you know, anti-aircraft shells coming up. I don't know where it is. Well, this, you know, this interview could go on for hours because I don't talk about this all that much. But when I get started, you know, I get wound up. Just keep going. Well, here, well, this is Rabaul Harbor here with the volcanoes and our airplanes here with anti-aircraft.
Those were balloons that they put up to try to make you hit them. Is that what that is?
No, that's part of the airplane flying off.
Oh, okay.
And here we are coming back. This is the island that I lived on. Okay. Next question.
Okay. Were there any like memorable experiences that really impacted your life
during that time?
Yeah.
Well, not really. I mean, it all impacted my life. But it's not like some of these guys that had incredible experiences in Europe or captured by the Japanese. What we didn't know was that all these islands were occupied by Japanese. And we flew over these islands, flew right down here and into Bomb Rabaul. We never thought about what would happen if we got shot down. And it wasn't until I read the book Flyboys about George Bush's father, who was the youngest naval aviator in the service. And the Japanese, some of them, you know, were pretty bad. And they, if they killed a guy, they ate his liver. Can you believe that? They did. They really did. But we were never told that. But if we'd ever been shot down here and captured, we probably never would have survived. But we didn't know that. We flew over and flew back again. There's ignorance.
Sometimes that's good.
It was. Well, it sure was, because we didn't worry about it. Okay.
What are differences between...
I can't hear you.
What are differences between World War II and the War on Terror?
The war where?
The War on Terror.
Oh, the War on Terror. Well, World War II was a real world war, and against the Nazi Germans primarily, and the Japanese. And we didn't have terrorism. Nobody came to this country and blew up buildings or anything. We were sort of afraid of that before I went into the service. I remember talking to guys when I came out to Oregon, that's another whole story, that were down on the coast and they heard the Japanese were landing from a submarine on the coast, and all these guys got out their hunting rifles. This was down in Reedsport. And they were shooting at each other, and they didn't realize, they thought they were shooting at Japanese. They didn't hit anybody, fortunately, and they finally realized what they were doing. But it was quite an experience. But I didn't have any single life-shattering experience that changed my life at all. It was an accumulation of a lot of things. One thing, the GI Bill. All the time I was over here, you couldn't go anywhere, couldn't spend any money, and I was a master technical sergeant, just as high as you can go, as a non-commissioned officer, and I was earning flight pay, saving money like mad because I was going to go to college. And then the GI Bill came along, and they paid for all of us. That was a life-changing experience, I can tell you, for thousands, if not millions, of Americans. Kids my age, you know, I was, 23 when I started college. And they were all kids my age, you know, and many of them had never had a dream that they were ever going to be able to go to college. And I was determined that I was going to go to college, so I saved all my money to go to college. When the GI Bill came along, I bought a car, paid cash for it. I had a good time.
When you ended your period there in the South Pacific, how did the ending come? Your time rotation was done and
rotation.
You were sent back?
Yeah. But these guys over in Iraq now, you know, they say, oh, well, we've been over here 6 months, you know, and we're due to go home. We were over a year and a half. We didn't think about going home. They're crying out loud. It was different, completely different situation. I think, I'm not saying more was expected of us, because I wouldn't want to be over in Iraq, I can tell you that, because they don't know who their friends are and who their enemies are. Their enemies are all dressed in their pajamas, you know, and you can't tell us, you know, a terrorist from some guy that works in a grocery store. We didn't have that problem. We wore uniforms and we knew who the enemy was. So that's the major difference. I think. It was easier, more direct.
What lessons do you think our generation could learn from World War II?
Well, you're from a good family, but I think you need to just grow up and be involved as you grow older. And I, for one, am very concerned about this problem of global warming. And I don't know if you have Al Gore's book at home, his latest book.
I don't know. My
Talk to your parents about it, because they should have it and read it, and you should read it. It's full of wonderful graphs and charts and photographs, because global warming is going to overwhelm the world. It really is. And so the best thing I can urge you to do is to get an education, get involved with things, and understand what the problems are. And global warming is a major problem. Here we are talking. There's nothing mentioned about global warming in the last election. I couldn't believe it. Nobody, Democrat or Republican, ever mentioned global warming as a problem. And it is a problem. It is a problem. And so the best thing that can happen is for you guys, as you grow up, to, you know, get involved. I have grandchildren over in Norway. My first wife was Norwegian. And they're about your ages, as a matter of fact. I have a daughter that's 12. I have a granddaughter that's 12. And a grandson that's 8. I don't know how old you are, but that's probably pretty close, isn't it?
Well, she would be about 15.
And 15.
He's
11.
So you've got about 3 or 4 years on them. So, but anyway, I mean, my advice still holds. You know, just don't get caught up in, you know, where the next candy bar is going to come from or something like that. Because there are major problems facing the world today that we didn't have, God, it was 60 years ago, 1946, exactly 60 years ago, that I got out of the Marine Corps.
So you got out after the end of the war.
Yes, I did, because I was in the regulars. I couldn't get out right away. They kept me to the day. On April 20th, they let me out.
And where were you then?
I was at Cherry Point, North Carolina, on the East Coast, always on the East Coast.
Doing, again, navigation training? And
well, some, but they didn't need navigators anymore. And I'd been recommended for a commission overseas, and I never got it. And when I got back to the States, finally I got a letter saying that you were favorably considered for a commission, but since the war is over, we don't need any more navigators, and so, you know, you're not going to make it. We're going to muster you out. So
where were you when the official end came?
That's an interesting story too, Larry. I was sailing in a ship coming back from Emeru. We were sailing under the Golden Gate into San Francisco Harbor the day they dropped the first atom bomb, and we went to some, I don't remember what base it was nearby. And the day that I got back, my family at that time were living on the East Coast in Brooklyn, New York, of all places. And I took the train across country, 5 days across country, was riding the subway underground, and I came up in Brooklyn, and everybody was yelling and dancing and screaming. It was VJ Day. And I didn't even know it. So that was an incredible experience.
VJ meaning victory in Japan. There were actually two.
It was VE Day, victory in Europe, and then VJ Day came later.
Yep. And then you had another year to go then?
I was out then.
Oh, you were out then. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Well, no, excuse me, I wasn't out then.
Yeah.
That was in August 45, and I got out in April 46.
So you had a few more months.
6 months.
Right.
Oh, I did all kinds of things that had nothing to do with flying anymore. I worked, you know, in a forestry unit, cutting trees and building things. And I worked in a landscape outfit. That's why I'm interested in landscape architecture. And we planted shrubs and took care of shrubs and all that stuff. And since I was a master technical sergeant, technically, you know, I wasn't supposed to do any work. I was supposed to get somebody else to do it. And one of the jobs, I did all kinds of different things. One of the jobs, I was in charge of the barracks for commissioned officers, bachelor officers. They call it BOQ, bachelor officer quarters. And I was sitting there at my desk, and there was this young lieutenant sitting there, and I was talking to him. And the phone rang, and he grabbed it and picked it up and said, "It's your Nichols. Start talking." And I could hear him. This guy said, "This is General so-and-so. Who are you?" You know, he said, "I want to talk to Sergeant Broom." And, oh, jeez. I mean, it's lucky that, that poor lieutenant didn't get busted right on the spot. So he told me, he said, "Don't you ever let anybody answer this telephone but you." He said, "I want to talk to you." And all he was trying to do was find out if some guy was there, you know. But I remember, "It's your Nichols, start talking," and rah, 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 this big voice came over. Jeez.
Did you ever get a chance to meet any of the famous names in the war period there? Generals or...
No, except a guy that was a navigator in my squadron who was a staff sergeant. I was senior to him. Retired as a brigadier general in the Marine Corps, and he's a good friend of mine. I don't call him General Bartlett, I call him George. But no, I never did meet any of these famous people.
Yeah. Well, do you want to transition into more modern times? Talking about global warming kind of leads us into the Wetlands Conservancy thing.
Yeah. So, well, you know a little bit about it already because you volunteered.
Yeah. How did you get to Oregon?
Well, another long story. I went back to my little hometown in Connecticut. And the love of my life, we split up, you know, during the war. That was a terrible thing. And so I went back there anyway. And there were a couple of people that I looked up. And one lady, she was just wonderful. She had died of cancer. And then I looked and tried to find other friends of mine. And they had just gone all over the place. And so I figured, well, geez, you know, why stay here? And I had met a guy while I was still in the Marine Corps who lived in Hood River. You know where Hood River is?
Yeah.
Up here at the Columbia. And he and his brother owned an apple ranch. They don't call them farms out here. They call them ranches, you know. So Ben said, "Well, why don't you come out to Oregon?" He said, "We have to hire somebody. Might as well hire you." So I did, and he did, and I worked on that farm, of that ranch out there, for about 5 months. And then I applied to the University of Oregon because I heard it was a good school of architecture and was accepted. And I've been here off and on ever since, except for a little over 2 years I lived in Norway. So I have a son, an attorney, who lives in Norway now. He's 53 years old. So time flies. And I have grandchildren over there. But that's how I came out here, because there was nothing back there. Nobody, no people. And I've always been people-oriented. There was nobody that I knew, and I just didn't want to stay there. But everything that I loved about that place was gone, you know, all the people. So I came to Oregon.
Okay, you got some more?
How did you get interested with the Wetlands Conservatory?
Well, I married Althea Pratt, you know, who lives in the old Pioneer House here. And there's wetlands all around the place there. And we were walking around looking at these wetlands and thinking, geez, there ought to be some way to save these wetlands, because at that time the city wanted to fill them in and put a great big pipe down the middle and just use it as a drainage way, because wetlands, you may know, form in low places. And also about that time, a friend of ours who was director of the Audubon Society said, "There's a conference up in Seattle on land trusts. You guys ought to go up there." So we did, and boy, we were convinced. The speakers had us absolutely convinced that a land trust is the way to go. So we came back and talked between ourselves, and we decided we'd form a land trust to protect the wetlands of Oregon. And we started with the Hedges Creek Marsh. And don't ask me when. That was about 1980. Yeah, it was 1980.
What's the difference between a marsh and a wetlands? Is there a difference?
Well, wetland is a generic term for all kinds of marsh. A marsh is a wetland that doesn't have any trees in it. It's just herbaceous. Plain. You know what herbaceous means? Herb. Like, in other words, cattails, sluice edge, and stuff like that. A forested wetland has trees in it. In the south, there are a lot of forested wetlands. We have a few around here with cedar trees and ash trees, but not very many. So, and then there's, there's a lot of breakdowns of lacustrine, you know, wetlands associated with a lake and riverine and palustrine, most of the wetlands that we were involved with are what we call palustrine, and that means they're formed in low places by streams or the water table coming up out of the ground, which is the way it is in the Hedges Creek Marsh.
So what we call Sweet Pond here is really Hedges Creek Marsh, would you say?
It's part of it, but that pond out there was dug. It's not a natural landform. It was dug for irrigation purposes.
The one by the Heritage Center here?
Yes, right down there.
Right between us and your house.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
But this whole area over by Kaiser Permanente, this whole area is called the Hedges Creek
Marsh. It's about 2.5 miles long. It's pretty big.
And that's all public property or private or
no,
both?
No, it's both now. There are some pieces that are still owned by private individuals, but most of it is owned by the Wetlands Conservancy or the City of Tualatin. So people can go there. But if you fall in and drown, it's your fault, you know.
Okay.
Were there any problems in the beginning when you created it?
Actually not, other than having to go through all the red tape, filling out applications, sending them into the federal government, all that. But at that time, everybody, including your parents, were very concerned about saving wetlands. And so, if anything, we were pushing people away, you know, because we couldn't handle it all. But I'm not involved with the Wetlands Conservancy anymore. I just figured I'm too old for that stuff. But they have grown, and they, you know, now own, I don't know, 1,000 acres or so. And they have some big holdings down on the Oregon coast and over in eastern Oregon.
And what's the purpose of the Wetlands Conservancy then?
To preserve wetlands for wildlife habitat, for educational purposes, to collect stormwater, to reduce flooding, to provide water to the groundwater because the water sinks down into the ground, into the water table, and for aesthetic purposes. So wetlands have a lot of beneficial uses. And so that's why they're still being protected. People aren't quite so concerned about them as they used to be, however, which is unfortunate.
What are some unique features here of this Sweet Pond natural area and the Hedges Creek Marsh?
Well, Sweet Pond is not a natural wetland.
Right.
It was dug, and so it doesn't have a buffer of wetland plants because it was dug out of an upland. It was just dug down, and I don't know where they hauled the stuff they dug out. We call that barrow. I don't know where they hauled it. Might have spread it around here, you know. But down behind our house and where we were working, you know, upstream before, these lowlands, wetlands are transitional areas. They start out with water in them, and little by little they fill in, and plants grow. You know, first just weeds and sedges and rushes, and then bushes grow, and then trees. Pretty soon, the wetland is not a wetland anymore. And beaver, of course, have really helped in the formation of wetlands. And for a while, there were hardly any beaver left in the United States. It's hard to believe now, because they're just raising the devil everywhere. They're beaver like coyotes. We never had coyotes in Connecticut. Now they do, all the way from out here. I lived in New Mexico for a while, and I used to hear coyotes howling at night. In the sound, I thought there were wolves. My father said, no, those are just coyotes, you know. But they were very common in the Intermountain West and in Oregon, of course. Never had it back east, but now they do. And the same with beaver. They trapped out all the beaver, but they've come back, and now they're a pest, you know, they really are. If you want to save a tree, you got to put some wire around it, or they'll cut it down.
What will happen to the conservancy in the future?
Well, it's been going on now for 20 years, more than that, 26 years. And we have all new people. None of the people that were involved originally are involved anymore, except my wife. She's still on the board, but they're all new people. And we have an executive director. Her name is Esther Lev. She's a very neat lady. She's a biologist and botanist. She knows all about plants. She's learned about animals and wetlands. And she has a knack of talking to people. And so the role of the Wetlands Conservancy has sort of expanded in that they don't now own and acquire as much property as they used to, but they work with other groups to protect larger areas. I mean really big areas, 100 acres, 1,000 acres of wetlands. So the mission of the Wetlands Conservancy has changed a little bit. The mission is still the same, to protect wetlands, but how they do it has changed.
And what do you predict will happen here in this area then, Jack, right here? What would you hope to see happen?
Well, what I'd hope to see is somehow to get somebody with some money to get out there and cut the trees that are out there in the pond and dig it down again like it used to be. What's happening, as I said, wetlands are transitional areas. You can see it right out here now. When I first came to wherever we are, Tualatin, about 23 years ago, 26 years ago, we used to skate out here. It was colder in the winter then. There were no trees growing in there. It was just open water. It would freeze over, and we would go skating out there. Not anymore. It's, if you go down there now and look, you see trees growing everywhere. And that's the transitional use. And in a few years, if nothing is done, Larry, there's not going to be a pond there anymore. The pond used to be about 4 or 5 feet deep, and now it's about this deep. And it goes dry every summer. That's another thing about wetlands. Wetlands are not wet all year long. They may be, or they may not be. But they have wetland plants, and the soil is what they call hydric soils that normal plants won't grow in wetlands, but there are wetland plants, and they're called hydrophytes. Hydro is a Greek word for water, I guess. So you have hydraulic systems, hydrophytes, hydric soils.
And what particular wildlife have you observed changes of here since you've lived here?
Well, because of all the development around here, much less wildlife. I mean, it used to be all kinds of ducks and herons and rails, and there were rabbits and otter and even a few coyotes and skunks and foxes, everything. All around our house, deer used to come into our yard and eat all Althea's rose bushes. Well, they don't anymore. Well, they did. Last year, I saw one right in our front yard. I couldn't believe it. It got lost somehow. It was getting ready to think. I thought it was going to jump over our hedge and go out into the drive, into the street, into Boone's Ferry Road. But so I went around and spooked it back, so it ran back to the west, into the fields and where the trees are. So it isn't that wildlife has changed, but there's just nowhere near it as much as it used to be, nowhere near.
Well, Ken, you were talking about global warming, warming a while ago. Yes. Do you think any of the changes that we're seeing here in Tualatin could be attributed to global warming?
Probably not yet, but just minor things.
What would happen as we don't address that global warming issue then our area?
Well, it's hard to predict because in some places with global warming there's more rain like we had. You know, we never used to have rain like that around here in Oregon, ever. We used to have snow in the winter. You know, do you ever remember seeing snow? Just almost never.
Yeah.
And so it's changed. And what's happening is that the creeks are drying up. But up on Mount Hood, the glaciers are melting back. So right here in Tualatin, we're fortunate. We don't see too much change. But down on the Oregon coast, there is. And up on the mountain, there is. So it's in the extremes. Well, I could go on and on about global warming because there are all kinds of signs there. And George Bush just does not recognize, he refuses to acknowledge that the glaciers are melting and the Arctic ice is melting and the ocean is rising and coral reefs are dying, and on and on and on. And people are being flooded, and we have major droughts where we never had before. So we're lucky. Right here, we don't feel the effects so much because we're up high enough. We don't have a flooding problem. We've got a creek that eventually, what's happening, one of the things that's happening is that Hedges Creek and all the creeks used to run year-round. They don't anymore. It rains like the devil in the winter, The creeks come up and they flood everything and it all runs down from the river and from the river to the ocean and so forth. And in the summertime, it all goes dry because there's no rain. None at all. And the groundwater is going down. So those are the things that we do see.
Are you on city water there, or do you have a well this weekend?
I had a well, but we are on city water.
Okay.
Because the Unified Sewage Agency was putting a sewer main through, not through our property, but next to it. And they didn't want to deal with the water, so they pumped all the water out, and they pumped our well dry, pumped the marsh dry. And after 3 years of that, I said, to heck with it, and I paid a couple of $1,000 to get on city water.
But in the old days, they had a well there, or they got
a spring. Still, well, Althea says it was a spring. I don't believe it. You know, I measure that well. I still do every 2 weeks to see. And it's interesting. The water level was going down and down and down, and then about 5 years ago, it started coming up. And now it's pretty respectable.
And what's the quality of that water? Have you ever had that tested?
Oh, yeah, I did. In fact, I didn't change because of the quality of the water, but there's a lot of industry upstream from us, and they weren't too careful about where they dumped their stuff. And so the wetland, you know, got polluted. But I took the water from the well and had it tested at a test lab, and I went in there one time, and the guy says, geez, he says, where'd you get this water? And I thought, oh, wow. You know, I got it from our well. He said, it's about the purest water I've ever seen. And that must have been because the water was flowing through sand. If you dig down a ways, you hit clay, and dig down a little farther, you hit sand. If we ever have an earthquake, this place is going to really take it because we don't have a rock base. The rock is about 1,000 feet down. It's all clay and sand, and the Brett's floods came in and brought in more clay and sand and mud and rocks. So I hate to think what's going to happen if we have an earthquake. Mm-hmm. I really do.
Could turn to mush.
It does. It's called liquefaction. Mm-hmm. And this happens. There's a lot of soils in Sweden that are that way. And anything, if there's enough water in the soil, anything that vibrates soil will turn it just to like a gruel, you know, like cereal or something like that. And it has no bearing capacity at all. Nothing can settle it. It all just sinks down. So the liquefaction is a big problem. And this whole area is subject to liquefaction. Not just flooding, but yeah. If there's an earthquake and everything starts trembling, our house is just going to be on the ground. That's all there is to it.
Did you have some more questions on the Wetlands Conservancy?
Where did you move to?
Where did I what?
Move on to. After the Wetlands Conservancy.
What other causes did you take on?
Yes, I always have causes. One of them was the Heritage, the Historical Society. And another one is my fraternity down at the University of Oregon. Because I have a lot of friends. You know, anybody that knocks fraternities, in the past, they've been pretty bad. But let me tell you, the people that support the universities all over the United States now are fraternity and sorority people, basically. 90% of the money that's donated to the University of Oregon is donated by people who are either in a fraternity or a sorority. I lived for 2 years down there in a dormitory. After all these years, I don't have a single friend. I can't remember the name of any of these people that lived in the dormitory with me. But I can tell you the names of all my fraternity brothers. What happened to them, a lot of them died. You know, I'm going to be 74 pretty soon, 84 pretty soon. And so a lot of them have died. Two of them have died just in the past month. So that's what I'm doing. And we've spent a lot of time trying to fix the house up and get it organized again. So that's what I'm doing.
What about, I heard something involving a Three Rivers Trust that you were involved
yes.
in. What was that?
Well, when we started it, I was talking to a lady by the name of Wilma McNulty about, you know, gee whiz, the city was cutting down all the trees and draining the creeks and everything. So I convinced her that they ought to form a land trust. And so with help of others, she did. It was called the Lake Oswego Land Trust. And then later they changed the name to the Three Rivers Land Trust because they acquired land all over here, you know, not just in Lake Oswego. But I was one of the prime movers. And another one was the Columbia Land Trust. I went over there and talked to them. And another one was the North Coast Land Conservancy. I went down there, Althea and I, and talked to them about what did we do, how did we form a land trust, what kind of people do you need. So I was primarily involved with the formation of the Wetlands Conservancy, but there's three others that I had something to do with. That Althea didn't, or nobody else did. I was the one that went over there and talked to them. And they say, well, how do you do this? How do you do that? And I tell them they did it. They have to be nonprofit corporations. And they're doing very well. I need to say that the Columbia Land Trust, well, than the Three Rivers, all of them, they're just fantastic. And the Land Trust is, I don't know if you know what a Land Trust is. A Land Trust is a group of people, individuals, who've gotten together with the mission of protecting land. Luckily, we have the Wetlands Conservancy. Our concern is protecting wetlands. Three Rivers Land Trust, that's just a name. They're not trying to protect wetlands or rivers. They protect open space, hillsides, whatever. The land trust movement in the United States is incredible. They own millions of acres. The most successful one that everybody knows about is the Nature Conservancy. They're far and away the biggest and the most successful.
So you've made quite a mark on Oregon, Jack.
Well, I think so. You know, when I look back on it, I wrote a resume for a year ago, 2 years ago. I was selected as the outstanding alumnus of the University of Oregon for that year, you know. And they called me and said, you've been nominated. And I said, geez, that's ridiculous. And they said, well, you send in a resume. So I did. And I couldn't believe it. I got picked. Well, that resume was wonderful because it tells all the stuff that I did. I mean, I talk for hours about these various groups. I've been president of just about every organization I ever joined. I've been lucky in that regard. I was president of the Historical Society.
That's right.
But as I've gotten older, I've gotten short-tempered. And the word is irascible. And I just couldn't take it. Larry is much more laid back than I am when he's younger. And so after 1 year, one term, I feared no more. That's enough, 1 year. And so Larry did it for two terms. And then Mark Parker now on his third term.
Something like that.
God.
What about, just here in Tualatin, let's review again for history purposes, your major achievements physically when you were still working, and included like Meridian Park Hospital, is that
yes.
right?
We were selected by the city of Tualatin. Yvonne Addington was city manager then, to do the first urban renewal plan for the city of Tualatin. And they didn't have enough money to do anything, but we made a lot of recommendations that they later followed. And I was chairman of the first committee to write a tree ordinance to protect trees in Tualatin. We did that. And I remember Arne Nyberg, he doesn't like to be called Arne, but Arne is his name in Scandinavian, Norwegian or Swedish, Arne. But he doesn't like to be called Arne. He says, my name's Arne. Well, it's really Arne. But anyway, Arne came up with this wonderful thing. He said, we were trying to think of a motto, you know. He said, well, how about this? The trees in our city and our city in the trees. I thought, that's fantastic, you know. So every time I get a chance, I repeat that, and I give credit to Arne because he's the guy that thought of it. And there's a saying, another thing you need to remember, you can't take credit for everything you do. I mean, people hate you if you do. But somebody said, I don't know if it was Winston Churchill or somebody said, you can do incredible things if you don't care who gets the credit. That's really true. Really true. You work on things and somebody else gets the credit, fine. I don't care.
Yep.
But if I wanted to take credit for all that stuff, everybody gets sick of hearing about me, you know. And I wouldn't be able to accomplish anywhere near as much. And working with my fraternity now, I've got all these younger guys that are working their buns off, you know, to get things going again, and they're in their 30s and 40s. They're half my age. But they're full of what I call missionary zeal, you know, and they're just working away. Yeah. I don't feel like working that hard. I'm supposed to be smelling the flowers. But, you know, you can only spend so much time smelling the flowers. That's a figure of speech, of course.
Well, that would be a topic for another interview by somebody else, but here it is on November 9th that we're going to conclude this interview, and I'm recording that so we'll know the date, and we'll leave to some other young people another interview with Mr. Broom on some other topic, but I want to thank Laura and Ryan for coming today to start this process, and thank you, Jack.
Because I could go on for hours.
I know, and we'll just do that on another different topics on different
Well, no, I mean about World War II.
That's right. We only scratched the surface today.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank God. You know, I'd be up there with a bomb sight looking down, and I'd see all these puff, 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 puffs. Anti-aircraft shells exploding, but they were below us.
You want to explain any of the pictures there further?
Well, this is just a guy that I didn't know him all that well when I was overseas, but he formed a group of people in squadrons and so forth. My picture isn't here. Somewhere in here I got a picture of me. These are all the officers, and these are air crews. And of course I knew the navigators the best, like this guy here. But somewhere here I am here. That's me, believe it or not. My pilot is dead. My co-pilot is still alive. My radio man is still alive, this guy here. He's now 78 years old, it's hard to believe. And he lives back in New York, in upstate New York, and we talk on the telephone about once a month. Most of these pictures are not all that interesting, but up here, kind of neat pictures. Here we are coming in low level. We spent quite a bit of time just shooting up the Japanese would they plant gardens because they were bypassed along with everybody else. And one of the ways they could survive was to have a garden. And so we would try to deprive them of their gardens, and we had to bomb their airstrips because if the weather was bad and we didn't get down there about every other day, they'd have airplanes in the air. And they'd attack our ships, and they'd come and bomb us. So whenever we could go down there, we did. That was our job, to keep them on the ground and bypass them. And I remember one experience, I'll never forget it. We were flying up from Emeru up to the Philippines. We didn't go all the way, but the 7th Fleet was coming up ready to attack the Philippines. And they were on our left. And I can remember ships as far as you could see to the horizon, back, out, and up. Thousands of ships, every kind of ship you can think of, aircraft carriers, battleships, cruisers, oilers, transport ships, just. And I was thinking then, you know, how on earth could the Japanese ever think that they could beat us? But, that you know, if you later on read more books about the Japanese, they were impressed with their own ability to wage war, and they thought we would just give up, and of course we didn't. And after we'd come in, you know, after we land, we'd have a debriefing, and there's the guys, and this is a friend of mine, Hal Brunker, that they would talk about, you know, what they saw and what they did and all that stuff. Pretty good picture of an airplane. And part of the time I spent, I can't see it, there's a dome up here, we call the Astrodome. The navigator had a compartment back here behind the pilot and the co-pilot. But if you were going to be bombarded, you had to creep through a passageway up to the nose. When I think about that now, excuse me, the creeps. Having to creep because it was about this wide and about this high. And I was a skinny kid, well, I could get through there. But not everybody was a skinny kid. There weren't any fat kids. Nobody was fat in those days. Nobody. But some of them were big, broad-shouldered guys, you know. And these are the pilots. This was the commanding officer. He was a lieutenant colonel. He was the oldest guy, and I'll bet you he wasn't any more than about 30 years old. And this is my pilot here. He was about 23, and I was 19. And I thought Roger Stewart was an old guy. Well, we ended up being good friends, and after the war, I went to visit him several times. He stayed in and ended up being a colonel. These are just more various air crews. This is the guy. He was a staff sergeant at the time. He ended up being a brigadier general. And there were only 60 general officers in the entire Marine Corps, and he was one of the 60, which I think is pretty neat.
And he's the one you still keep in touch with?
Yeah. Well, I keep in touch with a lot of people. It's amazing how many people I keep in touch with. That's one of the things I do. I phone and write letters and keep in touch with people. People that I went to high school with, there aren't many left, but there's a few of them.
Yeah.
People that I was in the Marine Corps with.
Great.
These are the guys that kept the airplanes up, well, and other ground crews, and they were all just teenage kids. You know, you look at them there. You had one guy that we called Mother Antonitis. I don't know where they call him Mother, because he was kind of a worrier, but Mother Antonitis was probably 25. He was the oldest one of the bunch. And everybody, they would call him Mother Andrew. Everybody loved him. He was a wonderful guy. And these are various ground crews that did different things, transportation, headquarters, and so forth. Okay. Well, I don't know how much time you have. I don't want to take more time than you've got.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jack.
Take all my toys here.
Yeah, let's get the camera off your map.
I'm sorry that we made you not know how to close the door.
Well.